heritageradionetwork.com. We are burning down the house here on the 1st of December, 2010. Oh my, how the year has flown past. Coming at you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Brooklyn, I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. Yes, this is your weekly dose of design, architecture, and the creative arts. And thank you, all of you loyal listeners, 50,000 strong a week. Oddly enough, because Heritage Radio Network is mostly a food channel, our podcasts are ranked according to food in the iTunes collection. Thank you very much. We are the 151st most popular food podcast in the world. Way behind Chef Dave Arnold's Cooking Issues at number 16. Good going, Chef. But that is, you know, an incredible thing because the top people have millions and millions. We just have a few tens of thousands of you loyal listeners. Thank you so much. This evening's program is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. Since 1865, the Hearst family, yes, that Hearst family, right, the publishing company, yeah, that's right. Well, William Randolph Hearst's father made a pile in the gold rush of 49. And after a little run as a state senator, he bought the Hearst Ranch right there, over 151,000 acres of Pacific coastal grassland ranch, where they've been raising the finest grass-fed and grass-finished beef since 1865. You can learn more about Hearst Ranch at, sure enough, HearstRanch.com. These have been crazy days. Before I introduce our guest, I want to make sure that we'll be able to reach him. He was driving all the way from Eastern Connecticut to join us here in our two shipping containers, which have been repurposed as our studio and engineering alcove here in the garden of Roberta's Restaurant. And a storm of such protean magnitude swept along the coast that it was like a hurricane, and he had to turn back. This has been a week of very severe natural occurrences. It really makes me start to wonder whether the radio evangelist who's predicted that the end of the world is happening on May 21st of next year might have something. Just a few days ago, on Tuesday, there was a 3.9 on the Richter scale magnitude earthquake with the epicenter 80 miles south of Montauk at the end of this very island on which we now stand. Here, Brooklyn is the western end, and Montauk is the eastern end, you know, about 120 miles to the east. But an earthquake down in the seabed. How strange was that? Hard to believe. We don't usually have seismic events around here, although we are in a zone 2A, which means we are subject to moderate seismic activity. Thank goodness the building codes here locally have started to recognize that. Our guest this evening is Duo Dickinson, architect who's designed and built over 500 projects in over a dozen states in the last 30 years. Duo is the co-founder of the Congress of Residential Architecture, which we'll speak about later on in the program, and is the architecture and urban design contributor to the New Haven Register, and a contributing writer and design for the New Haven magazine. He's been a contributing editor in home design for Money magazine and co-host of a 14-part CNN Money website series, Homework. Mr. Dickinson is the author of 6 books on home design, and his 7th book, Staying Put, will be published in 2011 by Taunton Press. He's been the recipient of numerous awards for design, including Architectural Record House, Metropolitan Home, Met Home Awards, and various Connecticut and New York AIA, American Institute of Architects, Design Awards. His design work has been published in over 60 publications, including the New York Times Architectural Record, House Beautiful, House's Issue of Fine Home Building. Mr. Dickinson is taught at Yale, Roger Williams University, and the Harvard Graduate School of Design Summer Program, and has lectured at dozens of universities, AIA chapters, national conventions, and gatherings. So before we really get down and start talking serious architecture here, let's just ease into that with a little bit of music from Cuba, Chan Chan by the Buenos. That's right, just roll it.
Puerto voy para Mayarín. De Alto Cedro voy para Macané. Llego a Puerto voy para Mayarín. De Alto Cedro voy para Macané. Llego a Puerto voy para Mayarín.
This is Curtis. Come in, Mr. Dickinson.
Yes, sir.
Hey, how are you?
I'm alive.
Did you enjoy that little Cuban hurricane-inspired music?
What I really liked was the fact that I am now right up there with Al Gore for the world's largest carbon footprint in any given day.
Yeah, well, you know, it was brave of you to attempt the drive from all the way from eastern Connecticut.
Yeah, noble failure. Noble failure.
Well, hey, you could have gotten off at Greenwich and been here, Metro North. Next time.
I would love to be there.
Next time. Well, you know, if this goes well, you mind your P's and Q's, we'll have you back.
I'll do my best.
So, I wanted to start out talking about CORA.
Yes.
This Congress of Residential Architects. And before I give you the floor,
yep.
I have to say I have really serious misgivings about differentiating one kind of architect from another.
Right.
It's hard enough for us all anyway, what with unlicensed people poaching on our statutory turf, to then to get into subspecialties differentiating ourselves. Well, I'm residential, I'm not commercial. I think that has a potential to confuse the public who's already confused enough.
I agree with you. In fact, we ended up, when we had this idea, it was really born of the fact that Jeremiah Eck, a great architect in Boston, had given a series of about 20 summers' worth of lectures about residential architecture, which I ended up being more or less the keynote guy in the series of lectures for about 15 of those years. And we decided that the response to that program was so incredible, that so many people wanted to spend so much money for so little benefit in terms of the credits they were getting towards their continuing education portion of their NCARB requirements, that that we thought that there was definitely a need for people that do houses for a living to actually just talk to each other. And when we had several meetings initially in Washington, D.C., and then in Connecticut, it became clear to us that what we really were was not the Congress of Residential Architects. We were really wanted to be the Congress of Residential Architecture, and that meant that we opened ourselves up for contractors, real estate agents, anyone that dealt with houses in general. And that actually turned out to be a really nice move, because the truth is that what we really wanted to do was to diffuse the sense that there really was only one type of true residential architecture, which is modernism in the history taught in schools, but also in what's venerated in most competitions, or on the other hand, quote-unquote real, close-quote, residential design, which is what real estate brokers, unlicensed designers, any number of people sort of, and also all the ads that you see in Builder magazine advocate as being relevant. And what we really wanted to do was take style and pretense out of the picture and essentially let people talk to each other. And it's actually been quite successful. We have about 20 chapters, I would say 10 of which are very, very active. We have maybe 1,000 people that are actively receiving and sending information to each other. There's no dues. There's no requirements. Anybody can be a member. Anybody can form a chapter. I wanted to call them cells, but it was right at the right after the World Trade Tower deal, so we thought that was a little bit too provocative. But in truth, if you just go to the core architecture, that's C-O-R, and then the word architecture, one word, .org website, it's somewhat up to date, not completely, but you get a sense of what we've been doing, and the fruit of it all has really been where it's really come down to is that over the last year, a group of about 7 of us have promulgated what we call the CORA position paper, which the AIA has accepted as a resolution in the last convention. It was voted down, but received 1,000 votes out of the 3,000 cast. And
votes for what?
Votes essentially for them to take on these 8 position points that we had, action points that we had actually posited as needing attention in the profession in general. Not necessarily residential ones, but basically in general. And what ended up happening was that the board was impressed enough with what we did with nothing, no resources, no money, no lobbying, no anything. The amount of support that we got from an entire group of California AIA associations, the Central California Council, endorsed it and gave it a full-throated endorsement at the convention, that they said that even though we were voted down, what they wanted to do was to create a joint task force to actually take on what we think are seminal issues of misfit in the profession, one of which is exactly what you just touched on, the fact that there is no codified, there's no accepted universally agreed to set of definitions as to what a licensed architect is, a designer is, a landscape designer, a garden designer, a contractor, a design build contractor, all these murky, strange, non-defined relationships end up hurting people that have dedicated huge amounts of time, money, and effort into education and licensure, and end up denigrating the services of anybody who designs a building because you're always defined by your lowest common denominator.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you've had time to listen to some of our previous broadcasts, but this is something that we rail about frequently. And I'll mention his name again. He's been invited to come on, and he has refused to respond. The head of the Department of Architecture at Harvard Design School designs buildings. He is not an architect.
Oh, I know, yeah.
And I think that's a scandal. I think that's outrageous. I don't know how that can be allowed to stand. I mean, why did we bother to get licenses when there are some really prominent people who, wink, wink, I'm an architect. No, you're not.
Yeah, Philip Johnson.
Oh, he had a license. It took him 12 times to pass, but he did have a license.
But, I mean, he designed a lot of buildings, and he wasn't a licensed architect.
That's true, early on in his career.
Many, many, many.
Sure. Your manifesto. I'm calling it a manifesto because you're not here. You're not seeing that I'm wearing my Che beret.
I like that.
Right, Dan? Yeah, yeah.
I like that.
You're on. And I'm feeling rather revolutionary these days. I really want to take our profession back for the people who have really invested their whole lives.
Yep.
And have been willing to go through the fiery hoops of licensure.
Yep.
Put away these poseurs. Tell us about the 8 points of your position paper.
Well, they're actually very simple. I mean, the first point, I mean, if you want to go to the CORA website, right on the front page, you'll see that there's a link to the position paper. And it evolved basically over about 5 or 6 months. And the first one was incredibly firebrand and got a lot of people angry and turned on at the same time and was really railing against what the AA has done to the profession and also how licensure has been completely denigrated and how LEED accreditation has really been this incredible sham validation of.
So tell us what, you know, summarize the 8 points for us.
Well, the first one is basically talking about definitions, who does what, and shouldn't all the licensed professions and unlicensed professions deal with all building have a universal standard that all the associations can agree to? What is a licensed architect? What is a landscape architect versus a garden designer? All those things should be in one common document that then the states can take and use when they actually try to figure out how they grant licenses and who they give credit to or limit access to public construction to. The second one is basically saying that we need to figure out a way to encourage and actually promote integration of different disciplines. In other words, rather than have environmental designers compete with architects for projects, the reality should be that they should form teams along with structural people and any other discipline to make better buildings as a team versus be competing against each other for commissions and excluding the skill sets of the others. The next one deal is the one that is in a way the most popular and the most controversial and probably has the least possibility of success is that I think everybody who's licensed understands the continuing education and professional practice certification continuing education requirements and all those courses we take or all those articles we read and then go on the internet and say that we've read them and get our credit hours is such an enormous sham and is such a profit motive generated pile of time dump that means nothing to making us better architects.
Totally specious.
And is promoted essentially by the gigantic superstructure of commercial interests that we're advocating that why can't on each state's basis, why can't there be a clearinghouse for the validity of these courses, either by accredited architecture schools or by the Department of Consumer Protections, so that basically you can have a standard by which there is some actual benefit to your capacity to be an architect as opposed to going to a seminar, having a free lunch, and learning about the latest Anderson window product. So that's the action point three. Action point four is essentially taking on the incredibly difficult reality that not only are we losing market share because we have a long and growing legacy of cultural irrelevancy for most people that might use architects. We now have a collateral competitor in people that have LEED accreditation, and that they don't necessarily have to be architects, but they seem to have a professional status that is in some way superior to a licensed architect. We would like to advocate the fact that the profession and NCARB should reform itself so that anybody who's a licensed architect instantaneously and legitimately has all the credentials of anybody who has LEED accreditation. So there isn't any confusion as to, oh, well, I have an architect, but don't I need a LEED guy to do my building for me? We think that that's something where the AIA completely dropped the ball, and they even privately will admit that they dropped the ball in not taking control of
absolutely
of being legitimately engaged in environmentally responsive design.
And we'll come back to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we think the next point, which is point five, is that that after a long internal discussion with a lot of architects all over the country, we have almost 300 endorsers who have contributed to this. We really do believe that the educational institutions of architecture have drifted away from the idea that you actually are engaged in a building profession and have created a rarefied elitist zone where the thought of architecture supersedes the reality of architecture, where it becomes a fine arts discipline as opposed to a discipline that synthesizes not only all the arts but culture, technology, history, the social realities of where buildings are. So we're asking that professional mentorship and internship actually be part of, which means integration into the non-academic world, be a requirement for obtaining a professional degree. The next point is basically saying, why can't the AIA consider decentralizing itself in a period where there are scant resources and the AIA is losing income? The idea of having one gigantic national convention every year and then having small bones being thrown to regional and local chapters, why can't the national organization, the AIA, downsize itself, distribute, in effect, reallocate its resources more regionally? Because in truth, the vast majority of architects that we know feel disaffected from the AIA, think that essentially that it has ignored them in the worst economic time in the history of our profession, and really want the AIA to step up to the plate. And that's actually, to be honest, why they are addressing this position paper, and why I think they've been actually, the leadership has been really incredibly responsive. They really have been. I have to hand it to them. They haven't come up with their half of our joint task force yet, and I hope they will before we have a meeting next week in New Orleans. But still, they have been pretty right, pretty much there. The last point number seven, not the last one. The point number seven is basically saying that
I've been keeping track. You're already up to eight, but that's okay.
Well, actually, this is number seven. Number seven is maybe I muddled it up a little bit, but number seven is the recognition that just like hospital design, prison design, any number of different disciplines in architecture that are recognized as special elements within the profession, that residential design has a unique way of creating buildings, which is distinctive from all other types of professional practice, and needs to actually have as much, but not more than, as much professional preparation in terms of courses offered in schools. You realize that of all the schools of architecture, that are accredited, about 120 some in the United States, that only 20 of them have as part of any of their curriculum a residential course, and only one of them, McGill, has a in place intact residential component to their educational format.
Right, and they're in Canada.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. And then the last thing is the one that is I think clearly the most incendiary, hard to deal with. This is point number eight, and I think really does have an enormous basis in legitimacy. Is the essential reality that over the last generation, architecture has found religion. It's become fundamentalist, and it really worships at one God, which is the God of high modernism. That's not in terms of what the profession does, but that is what all the voices of the profession, what all the educational institutions essentially use as, not all, but the vast majority use as the essential sieve through which all building design is presented.
Yeah, it's a nominal paradigm of architectural reality.
It is, and we have, there's so many anecdotes, but I want to give you two or three because I know that a lot of people are, you know, especially in the belly of the beast in New York City, the land of, you know, Leva-skinned glasses, black clad, wearing, you know, slim gallery goers.
Hey, watch it. I'm wearing all black today.
Me, I am too, actually. So I'm guilty as charged, but I'm not slim. I'm a linebacker, so it's not, you know, that'll never happen. But the truth of the matter is that a person who ran an architectural competition, nationwide one, came up to me and said, you know, Duo, we support you because at the last the last competition we had, there was one of the judges came up to me and said, "I'm sorry, but anything that isn't a truly modernist or piece of architecture, I can't even begin to think about giving an award to." And they had to sort of pull him aside and try to talk him out of it. But the truth was, there wasn't a single piece of architecture that had anything but a modernist cant to it. And 7 years ago, in a talk that I gave, I think it was in Austin, Texas, I basically said that in a survey of the last 5 years of record houses, I had actually found only five houses out of the, I think it was 50-some houses, that actually had a pitched roof. And that freaked out the editorial board there so much that they actually did an analysis of it. And one of the editors came up to Jeremiah Eck, my cohort, and said, "No, Jeremiah, here, I want to show you this. We did an analysis over the last 7 years and 5 years, and guess what? There were actually three houses that had a pitched roof." and so what you have in that last point essentially is the fact that there is a huge and growing divide between a core group of people that talk to themselves, preach to themselves, design for themselves, and think of the rest of the world as basically bourgeois fools, whereas the vast majority of architects design in the real world, earn a living designing, build buildings, and deal with the fact that every building has to be judged by a building code and a local funding environment.
And meanwhile, and we're going to take a break in just a couple minutes here. And meanwhile, in the midst of this, where is the American Institute of Architects? For my own part, when they threw a party for Prince Charles, who I regard as one of the primary anti-progressive, let's just, you know, forget the stylistic flourishes, just anti-progressive forces, when they threw a gala for him in 1988... I said to myself, this is money for nothing. So let's take a little break on that theme.
Terrific.
Cue. This is Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, brought to you this evening by Hearst Ranch since 1865, the finest grass-fed, grass-finished beef raised on 151,000 acres of Pacific Coastal Grassland Ranch. Learn more at HearstRanch.com. Our guest is Duo Dickinson, architect and manifesto writer. Now, where are you, where's your office?
Madison, Connecticut.
Yeah, that's way east, man. You're
kind of in the middle of the state. It's way east of you, that's for sure.
Way east of New Haven. And that's sort of the outer limits of my zone of awareness. Although
there you go.
I used to spend time over in Wakefield, Rhode Island. So I'd wave when I went past.
There you go. We're easy on, easy off.
Yeah. We've got a nice little downtown. There's a little sandwich shop that's so retro that they don't take credit cards.
That's right. And they're also the best bookstore in America.
So you say. Okay.
Well, no, actually, I don't. But the woman that owns
one of the
does,
best. Yeah. So. Cool. Of the list of 8 points, the one that really, really has me rather upset because it's a fraud is lead AP, accredited professional. You could be a high school dropout and be lead AP.
Got it, baby.
And how does that make you a professional? You cannot be a professional.
Well, I guess if you get any money for anything, you're a professional. I mean, I think a paperboy is a professional. If there are paperboys anymore.
No, I don't think so. I don't know. They're paper men, and they drive around in cars.
Well, what is very interesting,
but,
you know,
but professional,
what
but,
I think is...
Yeah, but this is, you know, this is one of the problems that we have in architecture, is the, you know, the academic people who themselves aren't actually architects,
yep,
who have opinions... Is the yeah, perversion of the English language. A professional is someone who has a license that has been granted by a higher authority,
right,
denoting that you actually have advanced knowledge. And administering a checklist, which is the lead system,
yep,
does not a professional of
well,
you make.
I think what has become known, I think, in the last 2 or 3 years with a bunch of exposés is a lot of the core tenets of the LEED movement is essentially, just like high modernist architecture, is religion. It's essentially a belief system that supersedes reality and essentially creates value by being opaque. And when you make yourself completely not understandable by intelligent, well-informed people that have not gone to your two-week course,
then you have a cult.
And the truth be told, is that there are a lot of these around, and LEED is just the one that is has the best PR. But if you're a certified kitchen designer, or if you are a certified closet interior designer, or if you're somebody that takes a one-week course in financial planning and then gets three or four initials after your name, essentially what you are is a salesman that has been given a lexicon of verbal tools to essentially make yourself seem to be the key to a font of knowledge and actually, in this case, retributive, salvational truth that will expunge you of all the guilt you have for driving a car that gets 12 miles to the gallon. And that huge fallacy has been proven, I think, many, many times. In many ways, sadly, because it throws the baby out with the bathwater, is the Green Movement has, to a great extent, jumped the shark. What ends up happening is that when you can have LEED accredited toilets or LEED accredited roof colors or LEED accredited products that sell for 2, 3, 8 times more than their competitors, people then begin to say, well, what's the quid pro quo? I mean, I'll feel better because it's made from salvaged something. But what is actually where am I actually stopping slaves in China from making this stuff and then having a huge carbon footprint to bring it over to where we are? So I think people have really made. I think there is a growing suspicion that much of what LEED represents is hype and gloss and has all the good intentions in the world, and I'm old enough to have gone through the late 70s and drawn in about 50 solar panel installations that have all since been removed for hot water heat generation.
Because it didn't work.
Well, they worked great at making your roofs leak like a sieve, and then they stopped, and they seized up, and it all...
Yeah, where they didn't really work.
But Jimmy Carter paid for it, so it was okay.
Yeah,
but it's one of these strange phenomenons where cyclically, architecture in general dives into to systems that are salvational, like the Usonian house, or even like Bernard Maybeck's, dropping the burlap bags into slurry and then tacking them on the walls of his studio. The idea that we could reinvent technology by sheer genius rather than the kind of wonderful Darwinian survival of the most economical, durable product way that building technology evolves, like all other technology.
Yes, case in point, you can't get Stony Creek granite anymore.
Right.
But you can, as a sustainable material, because once it's been fabricated, it's good forever, you can get a stone countertop, which probably was quarried in Turkey,
exactly,
shipped to Italy to be sliced into wafer-thin pieces, and then maybe shipped to China to be honed and polished, because they don't have air quality standards there, and then shipped to LA and trucked across the United States.
And it is green. And it is green. It's sustainable.
Yeah, yeah. And but you
really
spend all your.
With all these things, the phrase that was made popular in Watergate is to be followed, which is follow the money.
Right.
Who is getting rich on the LEED movement? It is not. The LEED movement has not enriched the people who own their buildings as much as they have enriched themselves. And so there's this enormous profit motive.
Well, that's the problem with the organization that created LEED,
yeah,
are the producers. And this is one,
yeah,
of the reasons that Henry Gifford, a friend of this program, do you know Henry?
I've heard the name, yep.
Well, you should. We'll have to.
We should have a confab.
We'll have to hook you up with him. Anyway, as you probably know, Henry has filed a class action lawsuit.
That's how I know. That's how I know the name.
Right, and he was on. He spoke with us here in the studio about a year and a half ago, and smart guy. And really, there's no defense against his criticism.
No.
Of the USGBC.
No, I mean, you see these gigantic glass buildings, and you basically say, this can't work, and it doesn't. And it is not about energy efficiency. It's about religion. It's basically about saying that using certain materials in certain ways makes you closer to Gaia or something that enables you to have a connection to reality that you've always wanted but were afraid of. Because in truth, what the Green Movement has done is provided this enormous fig leaf for the gaping wound of ignorance that the vast majority of architects have about anything to do with integrating design to technology or the environment. So they have this ability to do something, to be part of a really cool subtext of really hip and innovative stuff done by people just like them.
Yeah.
In an affinity group that basically preaches to the choir about how it's cool to be green when actually, to be honest, the greenest thing in the world is to do the thing that costs the least amount of money now and in the future and has the longest durability and payback and the least offshoots of decay and need for renovation. So you basically build stupidly in an intelligent way, dumbly in an enlightened way, and you think about every site, well, you're automatically going to be greener than a glass building set on a hillside that costs twice as much or three times as much as a building that's made with traditional building technologies that just thinks about where the wind blows, the light comes in, and how to shed water.
Yeah, well, hold on to that thought. I want to come back and talk in more detail about the high religion of modernism and how it's not appropriate for most residential applications. Let's have a little cashmere.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. How's that for high design music, huh? Are you there, Duo?
I am here.
All righty. We're brought to you by Hearst Ranches, who's burning down the house on heritageradionetwork.com. But you knew that because you found us through the genius of the internet. We're very big in Scandinavia, by the way.
Cool.
I get email. I get fan letters. It's
in Scandinavian?
No, it's in English.
Oh.
No, I don't, but, you know.
Is there actually a language of Scandinavian? I doubt it.
They call it Skandinaviska, and it's a kind of a rent version of Svensk.
You see? Above my pay grade already.
Yeah, jeg teller lite Svensk. But anyway, it's because her first wife was Swedish.
Oh, there you go.
There you go. Anita. Anyway, look, we wouldn't and we couldn't. It would not be culturally appropriate for us to build in the fashion of Royal Barry Wills, for example, right? But at the same time, it wouldn't be culturally appropriate to be designing or building in the style of Falling Water, either, for that matter.
Well, the gigantic, stinking, dead moose on the table is, in fact, the style question. It is the great unspoken rift in our culture and also but in my chosen profession. And there was a book written not that long ago called No Bad Dogs. Well, I don't think there are any bad styles. I don't think there's anything wrong with anything that anybody wants to build ever. If somebody wants, I'm a free market person, and basically if you want to spend $100 million and build the Taj Mahal in Texas, God bless you. The truth is, though, that there has been a winner picked. There has been a conclusive and definitive fundamentalist religion that has been applied not only to people that might want to build something as the sine qua non of coolness, but it's also being force-fed and pushed through the skulls of all the kids, or almost all the kids, not all the kids, most of the kids going through architecture school. And the real memory that I have of walking into my first year studio at Cornell in 1973, I'm not that young, 1973, was on the wall, painted in true actual size, was the Modular Man, actually painted with all the right little inflections and marks and the whole routine,
right?
Because the previous year, the dean had actually fired three professors for being too ideologically perfect. And it was actually the earliest drumbeat of the postmodern movement of this idea of, wait a minute, we've bought into this thing to the extent where we really don't understand how buildings are made. We know how abstract sculptural design is applied to buildings, but we don't really know how buildings are made. And those three professors, whose names now escape me, but they all went on to different academic careers. They were called the Texas Rangers because they were all together at Austin and were brought to Cornell by, I think, this dean. They had actually alienated enough people by their absolutism.
Oh, come on. They couldn't have been Texas Rangers, because we know the Texas Rangers were Colin Rowe.
Oh, well, that's one of them.
Bob Slutsky.
Yep.
John Hadick.
And they actually brought this crew with them. Because Rowe came up to Cornell and basically brought these guys with them, or they followed him there.
So they were the acolytes. Okay.
They were the acolytes, and they all got removed.
Shit canned. We can say that.
We can say that on this. Okay.
We're not beholden to the FCC rules, because this is not broadcast.
Oh God, I feel much better.
We can drop the F bomb, although
take a chill pill. But the truth was that I walked into a situation where they took the roof off, and basically there were still plenty of high modernists there, but there was several people that weren't. And Greg Lesnikowski, whose name you might know, had an incredibly wonderful, like, 20-year run as somebody that advocated the fact that organic architecture that comes from the earth and from the context and from your heart, was every bit as appropriate as high modern architecture, and nothing was wrong with anything.
Yeah, but
I believe that.
Yeah,
but the truth is that we have picked a winner.
Well, in the neo-cubist halls of Cooper, John Hadick, my dean, would have none of that. If you wanted to build hobbit houses, go to Pratt.
Right.
Here's the door.
Right.
May I help you?
Right.
Because it was his feeling, because it was his ethos was rooted in the traditional social contract, in which it was understood that you would learn how to build after you got out of school.
Yeah, and you could make the case that you do have to dial back everything except the most essential elements of design to figure out a building later. But the problem is that when you never figure out how to build a building, you make constructions that aren't buildings.
Oh, I know. And the people who are supposed to be teaching building technology do a piss poor job of it. We can say that too.
Yeah.
From time to time, I'll drop in on the Cooper student show every May.
Yep.
And here was a drawing, and it'd been scrubbed over, which showed real effort, and that was fine. I liked that. And it was an attempt to show a large scale building section through a modernist building. And it was being displayed, and it had not been corrected.
No.
I mean, this poor young woman, I think she was probably 20.
Yep.
I started giving a crit to one of her friends, and they said, well, wait, you know, Roseanne needs to hear this. And I said, you know, where is your professor? Oh, he's right over there. Would you like to meet him? I said, I do not want to meet him because he hasn't corrected you. You've got a section through, and you're showing a light fixture. Okay, great. You did a great job drawing a cross-section of an MR16 lamp. That's nice. But you're showing a zip cord plugged into an outlet in the ceiling. You
right.
can't do that.
Right.
Didn't they teach you anything about wiring? Well,
no,
we haven't gotten to that. Well, he didn't correct you.
Right.
And then, you've got this big piece of glass. How do you glaze that? You know, you're going to have to bring this glass in while they're casting the concrete.
Well, what I think is implied, and it's becoming less implied now and actually more directed, is that there are really two classes of people that deal with buildings. There are geniuses and there are technicians. And that is really what you have in Europe. You know, you basically have the people that are the people that think, and then there are the people that make the thoughts real.
Oh, well, they've even codified it in the United Kingdom. You can be certified as an architectural technologist.
Exactly.
It doesn't mean that you're an architect, but you do know how to put buildings together.
Do you want to know an interesting fact? Is that it's about a year and a half ago, the number of people in the architecture profession that were on unemployment in the year 2009 went up by 9 times. So if you had 5% unemployment in architectural trades, you had 45% unemployment in architectural trades in England. And the truth is that what the bottom line of all of this is, it's wonderful to have intellectual masturbation. Let's face it. Everything that's taught in university gets to a point where the people that are teaching talk to the people that are teaching about what they're teaching and how they're teaching it. And it becomes this huge do loop that really only makes teachers happy and professors happy. But the truth of the matter is that it's killing our profession. What's happening is that we are becoming so irrelevant to so many people. We're becoming caricatures. We're becoming fashion designers. That what we have to say, no matter how many words that no one can understand or use, and sentence structures that are so arcane.
Don't get me started on the magical mystery tour. You know, with ArchiSpeak.
Yes.
You know, one of my classmates, who's now a full professor, you know who I'm talking about. Diane, I caught her saying to someone, the students strenuously attacked a robust program. And I took her aside. I said, they use RPGs or just, AKs. She's like, you Philistine, you. Jesus.
Well, I just remember one incredibly brilliant, and he was, and he is, I'm sure, still brilliant student, introducing his project as being an exploration of Joycean principles. You know, and when you get to that level, you begin to realize that there is a role. There's the thing which drives me crazy. There's nothing wrong with academic architecture. There's nothing wrong with taking something and distilling it to the point where it is no relationship to reality, as long as there is the conduit to reality in the educational process that can take people that don't want to be professors for the rest of their life and give them a window into the world of actually getting buildings done. And what has happened is, and here's the tragedy, what truly has happened is it is as architects have drifted away from the ability for the average consumer at the either the residential level or at the any level to actually feel like they could touch what an architect does, the government has flown in and basically taken up the void and has created a series of approval processes and regulatory agencies and whole processes that have essentially said, well, since architects are these doofuses that fly off into the ether of intellectual know-nothingness, we, the government, must come in and we must tell everyone, whether they're an architect, an engineer, or a garden designer, that these are the standards that must, A, be obtained and then be reviewed. I were just about halfway through building a house in outside in Half Moon Bay, San Francisco. Uh-huh. That house took over $400,000 of soft costs to get through the building permit process that took 2 years, and dig this, it was as of right with no special exceptions, no variances, nothing. We followed every rule, and it took $400,000 of soft costs to get a house out of the ground. And that's what happens when architects become so irrelevant and untrustworthy that the basic sense is we have to protect ourselves from people that don't have our interests at heart, basically have their own interests at heart, and we must regulate them so that they will not perpetrate heinously ugly things, heinously environmentally insensitive things, heinously irresponsible things structurally, dangerous things. We must regulate them, and therefore boards, bureaucrats, technicians, engineers must look over their shoulder to the level that we had 11 consultants having to be paid for an as-of-right house to get a building permit. Yeah, 11 well, yeah. consultants.
And we're running out of time, unfortunately. I have two thoughts that I want to put out there and when we resume our conversation, and we will.
Great.
Because we have a lot to talk about. I think we're sufficiently like-minded that we won't come to blows, which is good.
Good.
One is how we've gotten in this mess. I lay squarely on the AIA and the standard contract language, which excludes so much responsibility that we have cut ourselves out of a position of authority.
Well, it's actually hilarious. If you actually ever work for the government at any level, the government agencies that hire architects have these ruled out sections of the contract that look like they're a redacted CIA document. Because they simply say, not on your life will we exclude you from responsibility in this thing. Yeah.
And I think what will save us is where we become universalists, and we take responsibility and authority for every fucking little thing.
Yes. Oh, you use the F word.
We can do that.
That's good.
It's Brooklyn. This is how we talk here.
Brooklyn.
This is how we talk here. I may be from Chicago, but we know how to talk there, too. And in that way, we can recreate our profession as being the scientists, the engineers, the technicians, and the artists all at once.
Mother of the arts.
And to the extent that we not only accept responsibility, but embrace it and say, yes, I will do that. Yes, I will do the structural I personally will do the structural calculations for this house. I will personally make sure that these details are going to be seismically restrained. I will take responsibility. Just for example, okay? One small example. It's I am the architect. I am responsible. I personally will look at my work to see that it is able to be constructed.
Right.
And to the extent that we have many interests, actually, we're stronger. We have just so much to talk about. I had a meeting this afternoon with my colleague, Nick Agnetta, who's another Cooper guy. And Nick is Nick's a fabulous musician. And his music.
And his music is not all frozen either.
No, and it's very. matter of fact, we're going to go out on Nick's music. His little composition, Geese, will be our outro. But we're not quite ready for that. I have to do a little housekeeping. And
can I just ask all of your 50,000 listeners to do one thing?
Absolutely.
One shameless plug.
Yep.
I have a blog called Saved by Design.
It's all right.
One word.
Mm-hmm.
And on there, I think you'll see a lot of different things. But as it relates to your food network, it will also talk about how I ate myself into being about 100 pounds heavier than I am now. So that's actually an interesting thing for your foodies to...
By, worrying about architecture?
Oh, just by not thinking and eating a lot and not working out. So
well,
it's an interesting tale about somebody who went all the way out and then came all the way back.
Well, you gotta listen to some of our other programs because we'll tell you how to eat, what to eat, and how to make it. I mean, it's a really interesting play. I hope that next time you'll be able to make it all the way here because...
I will absolutely make it a point.
I mean, we're all, you know...
It was just the weather that killed it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was a little mini hurricane going through there.
Oof.
And I'm sorry for you. I really am. It was a bit hairy here in the city also. Because we all wear many hats. You know, we have people who talk about art, and yet they're chefs. And here I'm an architect, and I was a line cook for 4 years. I supported myself.
And I was a line backer for a bunch of years.
Well, there you go. You can muscle your way right through any crowd. You've got the heft, you've got the mass, and you've got the brain. So
it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Trim down a little bit.
We'll be on anytime.
We'll have you back as quarterback. It's been Duo Dickinson here on Heritage Radio Network, Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, brought to you this evening by Hearst Ranch, hearstranch.com. Thank you for listening. Talk to you again next week. Thank you.